Hello. Imagine, if you can, a machine made up of 86 billion components, joined together in a network of 100 trillion connections. In computing terms, such a machine could perform the equivalent of 1 million trillion mathematical operations per second. And yet its network of connections is flexible enough for them to break, regenerate, and renew. Such a device, if it existed, would be the most complex system in the known universe. Well, such machines do exist. In fact, there are over 8 billion of them on our planet right now. Don't worry if all this is making your brain turn somersaults, because, if you haven't already guessed, the machine I'm talking about is the human brain. Today's guest on The Life Scientific has spent her career demystifying and explaining the brain to audiences around the world. Dr. Hannah Critchlow is an internationally acclaimed neuroscientist. And through her writing, broadcasting, and lectures to audiences, whether in schools, festivals, or online, she's become one of the public faces of neuroscience. Through her research and writing, she's explored the idea that much of our character, our behaviour, our beliefs are hardwired into us before we were even born. And most recently, she's considered collective intelligence, asking how we can bring all our individual brains together and harness their power in one superbrain. Hannah Critchlow, welcome to The Life Scientific.
Hello, Jim.
Now, Hannah, I should start by explaining that when you came into the studio today, you attached a set of electrodes to my head. I'm not sure if that's the usual way a neuroscientist says hello, but here we are. Do you want to explain what's happening?
Yeah, so I've hooked you up to an EEG machine and we're analysing the electrical activity that's going on within your brain. So you talked about these 86 billion units within the brain, these nerve cells, and they actually produce electrical currents, if you like, because they pump sodium and potassium ions in and out of the cell membrane. And that pumping of charged ion basically creates an electrical current which zips across from one nerve cell to the next nerve cell in the circuit. And that movement of electrical current basically creates our thoughts, our ideas, our emotions, and our behaviour instructs us how to interact with the world. And it's wonderful. And what I'm doing right now is measuring your electrical activity in your brain as you're thinking in real time.
So the sounds we're listening to now are the sounds of my thoughts.
They are. So I've transduced the potential difference in millivolts of your brain, if you like, into hertz that are audible to the listener's ear, so that we can listen to that wonderfully jubilant kind of process that's going on in your brain. And it is, it's dancing all over the place,
I'm
isn't
it? I'm thinking happy thoughts, Hannah, honestly. And I gather you did a similar experiment with Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury. What did you discover about what was going on in his brain as he meditated?
So this was an incredible experience. I was invited to the Hay Literary Festival in Wales. And Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, was at the time, he was Master of Magdalen College, where I'm affiliated at the University of Cambridge. And he very kindly let me kind of read his brainwaves live on stage in front of 1,800 people in the audience. And he meditated on stage in front of all of these people. And we could see this incredible burst of gamma wave activity. So that's the fastest frequency of electrical oscillation in the brain. As he was meditating, there was an incredible burst of gamma wave activity, which is what you would expect to see when somebody is very practiced and well rehearsed
right.
with meditating.
Because you try to listen to my gamma waves to see if I could try and meditate. Nothing.
That was a bit of a flat line, wasn't it, Jim?
But this sort of demonstration really is at the heart of what you try to do, to convey neuroscience to people in a fun, interactive way.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the little kind of live experiments really help with that because they bring the scientific findings, which is just, I just find, you know, as we're finding more and more out about the brain, you know, we've had all these new technologies that are allowing us to peer into the brain as never before and start to understand how our behaviour, how our consciousness is magicked up. Mm. You know, these demonstrations, these live experiments really help audiences to become interested in these topics and to gain some kind of an understanding, which I think is very empowering for them.
Well, Hannah Critchlow, you were born in 1980 in Leicester, but you had quite a peripatetic childhood, didn't you?
I did. Yeah. I was very lucky because I really enjoyed kind of moving around to lots of different environments. They're all in the UK, but my dad worked in academia. He's an academic registrar, so involved in kind of policy and admissions for universities. And we moved from Leicester up to Humberside. So I lived in Hornsey for a while and then back down to Northamptonshire. And then I went to university in London.
But even as a child, I gather your parents allowed you free rein to explore, just seeking out adventure.
I suppose so, in some ways.
Or maybe they didn't know.
They didn't know. They're about to find out. So me and my best friend in Hornsey, Susan Walker, I think we were quite inspired by the Famous Five, and she had a dog. And we used to just roam around the countryside. And there was, at the time, in the 1980s, there was quite a lot of derelict houses. And we'd actually collected keys over the years, so people's old keys. And we had a collection of, you know, tens of keys, and we'd just go to these derelict houses wandering around with her dog and a little picnic and kind of break in to the houses and try and find some treasure.
And I gather both your parents are very artistic people, as are your two siblings. You have an older and a younger sister. So your early fascination with science bucked the family trend somewhat.
Yeah, and I think my mum was a little bit shocked and I think she was a little bit dismayed, actually. My big sister's a music therapist and my little sister runs a company doing art conservation and restoration. And my mum and dad, very musical. And I tried, I really tried to be musical, and I was sent to cornet lessons and to sing in the choir, and I was sent for guitar lessons, and my parents tried to invest in it, but I really haven't got a bone musicality in my body. However, what I did find that I was good at and that I also really enjoyed was science and biology. And in some ways, it felt like I was exploring a new territory, because at home, you know, science wasn't really discussed. So it was like learning a new language and just finding out about these things that weren't familiar to me. I really enjoyed science as a
student.
And
of course, your love of cell biology started with your GCSEs. You then took A-level biology, chemistry and physics. At which stage, you had your sights set on a career in medicine, I believe.
Yeah, so it was interesting because my predicted grades were, you know, high enough really to get into medical school. But the careers advisor was really suggesting that actually I'd be better off becoming an optician, for example, or an editor. So for some reason, they weren't very encouraging about it. And I decided to take a year out after my A-levels, and I worked in a local hospital. It was actually a local psychiatric hospital that basically took patients from across the UK, the most challenging individuals really across the UK, and they'd been sectioned under the Mental Health Act, and so they were under lock and key. I particularly worked on the adolescent ward, so this was children that were 12 years to about 18 years old. And they were there 24/7, you know, their parents could come and visit and they could have friends coming to visit, but that's where they lived. So quite often I'd be put on a one-to-one observation and you'd be making sure that they were behaving in a way that wasn't harmful to themselves, because there was a lot of self-harm behaviour and also wasn't harmful to anyone else. And I'd be doing things like maybe reading Harry Potter with them, because the Harry Potter series had just come out, and sometimes we'd go out and play basketball in the courtyard, and there'd be music therapy sessions as well that were available. But quite often the clients would just be a little bit unresponsive and they wouldn't be able to interact. Quite a lot of the medication just made them go into a catatonic state, really, so it quashed any of their behaviours that were too challenging, but it quashed all of their behaviours and it made it quite difficult for them to interact with other people.
That experience working in the hospital really had a big influence on your subsequent career path, didn't it?
Yeah, it made me realise that I would probably find it too upsetting working in therapy as a doctor or in a hospital, and that there was a lot more that we needed to know about the brain, and there was a lot, you know, there was better treatments that needed to be found, really. That there was a real medical need for us to understand more about the brain.
Okay, Hannah Critchlow, so you didn't do medicine, you went off to study cell and molecular biology at Brunel University in London. What aspects of that course most engaged your imagination?
I think it was probably the work placement.
Right.
So, you know, the lectures were fantastic and I was very lucky. It was quite a small student cohort. There was probably about 120 students for each year. And the lecturers there had an open door policy. So we'd very often just go in and have chats with the lecturers and join them for their Christmas dues. And it was an absolutely wonderful experience. And I found it very motivating. And this opportunity to go and have two different industrial placements. And actually, I was invited back in the summer holiday of one of them. So I had kind of three different industrial placements. I just found it incredibly motivating. So I was working with my last placements were with the Psychiatry Centre of Excellence for Drug Discovery for GlaxoSmithKline. So this was based in Harlow in the UK. And we were working on looking at the different genetic and protein and cellular ways that medications for psychiatry might be working and where there might be a new way that we could start treating conditions. So they'd spent billions of dollars on creating state-of-the-art laboratories, and they also collaborated with scientists across the world doing really blue skies research, trying to understand the fundamental mechanism for how the brain works, how it creates our behaviour, how it creates our emotions. And they just had access to the most outstanding laboratories and equipment and facilities. And it was, you know, it was amazing being part of that time, that era of scientists that were working there. And during my internship, you know, a couple of years after that, I actually managed to do my PhD again with GlaxoSmithKline at the Psychiatry Centre.
They funded your PhD to do at Cambridge, and you were looking at dendritic spine plasticity. Talk me through that.
So you were speaking earlier about these 86 billion nerve cells or units within the brain. And each one of those nerve cells is connected to around 10,000 other nerve cells to create around 86 trillion connections in the brain. And I was looking at them where the majority of those connections occur. So there's these little structures called dendritic spines, and they're minuscule, absolutely minuscule. And if you imagine that as you're learning something new from the environment, what happens is a little filipodia, which is like a worm-like structure, basically reaches out from one nerve cell and tries to make contact with a neighbouring certain nerve cell. And when it makes contact, that's kind of learning. So I was looking at that process of connectivity, how it happens in the brain. I was staring down microscopes, watching it happen, and looking at the genes and the proteins that were involved in that fabulous process that allows us to learn from our environment and change the way that we think as we go through life. So it's fantastic. And I was also looking at the how, you know, we might have a genetic predisposition that might affect that process of synaptic plasticity.
Let's talk a bit more about this idea of brain plasticity, Hannah. The idea used to be that we're all born with a certain number of nerve cells in our brain, albeit a very big number, but that's it. But that's not actually the case. We can create new nerve cells.
Yeah, so there was about 20 years ago, there's a guy called Rusty Gage who's at the Stork Institute in America, and he found out something that was really groundbreaking at the time and has, you know, reverberated about around our way of thinking about our brain and behaviour ever since he made this discovery. But he basically discovered that within the brain, there's a number of different areas where you can have neurogenesis, which is basically the birth of new brain cells. And we know, for example, that exercise is implicated in increasing the rate of new nerve cells being born, and also exploring new places kind of exploring new ideas and meeting new other people can help those new nerve cells integrate into existing circuits so that you've got literally new ways that you can think.
Is this why lots of neuroscientists in Cambridge all go out jogging a lot?
Yeah, yeah.
They realise how important it is for neurogenesis.
Yeah. So it was really funny. So about the same time that this result came out, suddenly you'd see all these neuroscience professors jogging up and down the towpath. It's like, hi there, hi. Yeah.
But this neuroplasticity isn't limitless.
Oh, well, this idea is actually what spurred me to write my second book, which was The Science of Fate. And, you know, when plasticity had been discovered in terms of how our connections change in the brain in response to our environment, but also how we can allow new nerve cells to be born in our brain. There was really this big hype almost, where people were kind of almost saying that, you know, we can allow ourselves to be whatever we want to be. We can think our way out of anything. We can, if we just exercise our brain enough, then, you know, our brain can do anything that we want to accomplish, anything that we want to achieve, then, you know, the it's limitless. And, you know, in much the same way as, you know, this idea that if we go to the gym, you know, we'll be able to bulk up our muscles and have any physique that we want. Well, actually, no, that's not the case. You know, as with our body, the same thing exists with our brain. There are limitations. There's these biological kind of predispositions that have been given to us, maybe from our mum and our dad's genes, that basically shape our bodies and shape our brains. And I really wanted to write this book to try and make people think that it wasn't their fault if they were being affected by depression, for example, or anxiety or obesity, and that actually some of their predisposed behaviours were written into their brain. So there's quite a large component of our biology that's shaping some of our behaviours.
Towards the end of your PhD, you had an opportunity to work with neuroscientist and former director of the Royal Institution, Baroness Susan Greenfield. You were looking at neuroscience policy and how it could be applied to education. That must have been a very different experience from your lab work.
Yeah, so I absolutely love my PhD, and I really hoped that I'd be able to stay working with the psychiatry set at GlaxoSmithKline. But unfortunately, towards the end of my PhD, or shortly after, they actually shut down the unit, because although they had produced huge amounts of research that had had a lot of impact in terms of academics citing it and it being referenced within the academic community, they hadn't actually produced any new drugs for the pipeline. And so they were pumping millions and millions of dollars into this area, but they weren't getting a return. And, you know, it's not a public body, it's a business. And so they unfortunately had to exit, and they shut down the whole psychiatry set. And so I was like, oh gosh, I'm going to have to do a bit of a pivot in terms of what I want to do for my career. And an internship opportunity kind of came to my attention. A friend very kindly kind of forwarded it on to me. And there was an internship with Baroness Susan Greenfield working at Oxford at the Institute for the Future of the Mind. And it was helping to set up an all-party parliamentary group where we would discuss some neuroscience findings and how that could be incorporated into the classroom to help with child well-being and the way that they can learn and remember. And so I did a few-month work placement with them, and it was brilliant. I found it meaningful.
Mm. Yeah. But you weren't tempted to stay on in academic research. I mean, OK, so this unit at GlaxoSmithKline closes down. You weren't tempted to stay on at Cambridge and pursue academic research.
Do you know, I mean, I loved my PhD, and I even got a research fellowship at Magdalen College in the last year of it. So, I'd been pretty successful at it. And I really enjoyed it. But if I'm honest with you, what happened towards the end of it was that I was in a basement in a microscope room, staring down at these brain connections, thinking about schizophrenia and social withdrawal. And I was spending hours and hours and hours, you know, an unhealthy amount of time in a dark room. And I'm like, I made it worse because I was listening to Radiohead, and I was kind of rocking by the end of it. So I think I really wanted something that was a little bit more sociable. I think I missed social interaction, and I wasn't sure that academia was the way forward for me. And so I started, there was a job that was kind of advertised, and it was at Cambridge University, and it was bringing together the neuroscience community at the university and helping them with funding bids, also doing public engagement projects to raise the profile of neuroscience research in the community, and trying to see how we could collaborate kind of nationally, as well as raising the profile with policymakers. And so I did that for a few years, and then I was put on secondment and did the same thing, not just for Cambridge, but also nationally with the British Neuroscience Association. So now I was working with the community of neuroscientists across the UK. And it made me feel very happy, because I was still keeping in touch with all of these groundbreaking neuroscience findings.
Well, Hannah, for a number of years around this time, as you know, your burgeoning career in science communication, I gather you had rather unusual accommodation. You were living on a houseboat in Cambridge.
Yes, so I got this fellowship at Magdalen College during the latter part of my PhD. So suddenly I was a research fellow. And as part of this research fellowship, you got to dine with all the dons at High Table, which was a wonderful experience. But you also got free accommodation for a year. And so suddenly I had some money spare. And I knew that I wanted to stay in Cambridge because it's a beautiful place. But I couldn't afford a house there because house prices are pretty astronomical. But what I did notice was that as I walked down the river, as I did quite often, or as I ran to help with my neurogenesis, I noticed that there was this very dilapidated houseboat that had a for sale sign on its window of the wheelhouse. And the for sale sign basically said that it was exactly the same amount of money that I'd, you know, saved on accommodation as a result of this fellowship. And so on a total whim, I bought this exceptionally dilapidated old Merchant Navy lifeboat. And, you know, so it was bright purple. It didn't have running water inside. It didn't have a bathroom. It didn't have a proper stove. It wasn't properly insulated. There was no plumbing, no real proper electrics. And so I had to learn how to do all of these things, you know, with the help of the community, the boating community that were there. And I loved it. And I think, do you know what? I think that having the houseboat possibly was part of the reason that I was okay with not staying in the lab and working in the lab, because suddenly I had this new practical project.
And during this time, you were increasingly becoming the public face of neuroscience, giving talks at schools and festivals. Did you enjoy the experience of bringing science to new, unexpected audiences?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think everybody is interested in their own brain and their own behaviour. I think it helps them understand themselves, but it can help them to understand other people as well. And I think, again, it's going back to this idea of using interactive experiments and demonstrations to help audiences become interested.
In 2020, a year I think everyone will remember for pretty much the same reason, you were on a 12-week book tour of Australia. But of course, the pandemic hit, and so you ended up staying there for 2 years. Now, fortunately, your son Max was with you, but basically you had to carve out a whole new life in Australia.
Yeah, it was very unexpected. I finished the book tour and actually in New Zealand and got the last flight back to Western Australia, Perth, where a good friend was looking after Max with her son. And the pandemic had kind of started and suddenly the borders were closing. I managed to hot foot it back to Queensland, where Max had been in nursery for a little bit whilst I'd been on this book tour and whilst we'd been holidaying there. And suddenly then the international borders completely closed, the state borders completely closed. And so we were effectively kind of stuck in Queensland for 22 months. And so Max, we had a brilliant time. I mean, we were living in paradise. We were very fortunate. I think the schools really remained open because they had the borders so tightly shut. And so the schools were open, the parks were open, the beaches were open. You just had to kind of keep moving around on the beaches. And we were very, very fortunate for our time during the pandemic, and Max really thrived.
And for you, that's where you wrote your most recent book, Joined Up Thinking, while you were at your time locked down in Australia. And in that book, you explore this idea of collective intelligence.
Yeah, so it's a little bit ironic that I was kind of writing a book on collective intelligence and joined up thinking whilst the whole, you know, the pandemic was going on and lots of people were in isolation. So I managed to write this book where I explore things like, for example, we were talking about your brain waves. More recently, scientists have not been just analysing an individual brain electrical activity. They've been looking at what happens when groups of people start working together. And so if we were to analyse your brain and my brain and maybe the listener's brain at the same time, then we'd be able to pick up probably that our electrical brain waves would start to synchronize with each other. So they'd start to become in step. And that physiological alignment within our brain is linked to better learning and consensus building and better problem solving ability. As we start to think in the same time step.
In the book, you also explore the idea of a brain net, which I looked up. Apparently, it's a multi-person brain-to-brain interface, which sounds like science fiction. Do technologies really exist that might allow that to happen?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's new. It's new neuroengineering developments, but there's been, you know, it's not just Elon Musk that's been quite publicly talking about his Neuralink, but there's been neuroengineers that have been working across the globe for the last couple of decades, possibly even more, but they've found some really interesting things. So, for example, in the same way that I was hooking you up to the EEG machine, you can hook individuals up, you can put them in different places, so across the world, and you can actually take those electrical oscillations, and then you could convert those electrical oscillations, not into sound, as we did, but actually convert it into a magnetic stimulation so that signals can be converted from one person to another person so that you can actually read each other's thoughts in a very rudimentary sense. And so they've done this type of thing, and they've actually allowed people that are dotted across the world, not communicating in any other way, to play games like 20 questions, and they can successfully do it.
Looking back over your neuroscience journey, how much would you say is the situation changed in hospitals like the one you worked at when you were 18? How far have we advanced in helping young people or anyone with a mental illness?
It's very telling that a lot of the pharmaceutical companies have largely exited psychiatry. I think we still have a lot to learn about how our sense of reality from the world around us is formed. I think we still have a lot to learn about the developing brain as well, and how unique that developing brain is, how plastic it is, and how that offers up huge amounts of creativity, but can also create a window where it's quite vulnerable as well. So in short, you know, we still have a lot to learn. And unfortunately, I think the information that we do have, it would be helpful if that was more effectively implemented.
Hannah Critchlow, thank you very much for sharing your life scientific.
Thanks, Jim.